Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my privilege once again to present Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, Blowback, The Science of Coercion, and the book that we're speaking about today, The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, published in softcover by the Common Courage Press and copyright 1995. Chris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hello, Dave.
In our last half hour, we were talking about the recapitalization of Germany in the 1920s by American financial institutions to a considerable extent in order to keep the international financial international capital flows going. I'd like to talk about some of the institutions and individuals that were central to not only that recapitalization but a lot of subsequent events that you talk about. Let's start with Sullivan and Cromwell and the brothers Dulles, Allen and Don Foster.
The brothers Dulles. Well, the conclusion that we left off with was that that if the international financial flow of capital becomes clogged up, then the whole system breaks down. Well, then the next question is who's in charge of the plumbing? You know, who keeps it who keeps the plumbing open? The fact is that particularly during the 1920s, you had a really quite small number of people who specialized in this particular task. We're talking about fewer than 200 people worldwide who were international lawyers, senior executives of national banks of a handful of powerful countries, and so on. Sullivan and Cromwell was a law firm in New York, is a law firm in New York. It remains very powerful today. Specialized in putting together international deals and had sort of pioneered this whole concept of a multinational corporation back in the mid 1900s. After World War I, what happened was that John Foster Dulles was a lawyer, but he was also a banker, and His uncle was Secretary of State, and his other relatives were very well placed, and so on. And as things came to pass, Dulles was on the American negotiating team that put together the settlement, the financial settlement, at the end of World War I. I'm talking about John Foster Dulles now.
These were
the elder brother,
and these ultimately yielded the Dawes and Young plan.
Exactly, and. And as we spoke before, the first attempt to resolve who was going to pay for World War I led to the German inflation crisis of the early 1920s, which very nearly set off a new world war just by itself. What John Foster Dulles put together with a number of other bankers was the system by which the Germans would borrow money to repay the loans to England and so forth, which would then take that money and repay the loans to the Americans, who in turn would lend it to the Germans, and who in turn would pay back the British, who would pay back the Americans, who would lend it to the Germans. And you see how the cycle works. And as long as the cycle continues, John Foster Dulles was seen as the visionary captain of world finance. Dulles and a handful of others, Paul Nitzer, who was later to reemerge in during the Cold War, is a very important American Cold Warrior, sort of realpolitik advisor to a half a dozen American presidents. John Foster Dulles ended up as Secretary of State. His brother Allen ended up at the same time as Director of CIA. Several of the main financial empires that Dulles served. His family was wealthy in its own right, but his real job was serving the ultra rich, the Harrimans, for example, the Rockefellers, and so on. These really quite small circles worked together to recapitalize Germany, to you know, to profit off of the Roaring Twenties boom of that time. Now, and they set up a variety of different plans that ended up taking advantage of small investors when the bottom fell out of the market in 1929. But that's kind of another story. As far as what happened with Germany is concerned, is that you had a half a dozen or so of these early multinational corporations. I mean, the idea of a multinational corporation in a world where transportation is slow and making a cross-country telephone call is almost impossible, a multinational corporation in that kind of circumstances is quite an undertaking. In the 1920s and 1930s, what it led to was a half a dozen or so multinational corporations that bound together the financial elite of Wall Street on the one hand with the financial elite of Germany on the other. And this was a very well-documented process. There's nothing conspiratorial about it in the sense of, you know, some you know, kind of vast you know, Illuminati banker or Jewish quote unquote conspiracy type story.
No, there was nothing occult about this. This was one of the major capital phenomena.
Right, it's how the system works.
And far from being a Jewish banking conspiracy, as we're about to see, this ultimately led to the concretization of the exact opposite forces.
Exactly. This ended up as a contributing factor to the Holocaust, and here's why: is that one of the most important questions at the end of World War I was, what is a crime against humanity? What is a war crime? And the reason that was important, of course, is the moral question, and is also the fact that at the end of World War I, that ordinary people were more and more involved in the life and the democratic character of their countries than ever before in history, and because it was very expensive. Because all of the players agreed that if a country had committed a war crime, then it was responsible for paying some form of reparation for that crime. So the definition of what a war crime was, or the definition of what a crime against humanity was, became an economic question, in addition to being a legal question and a moral question. People like John Foster Dulles
his brother Alan, for example.
Well, his brother Alan, yes, and perhaps as many as two dozen other people, had a very strong interest in limiting the definition of war crime to the maximum degree possible, and obliterating, canceling, refusing to acknowledge that there was such a thing as a crime against humanity. Why? It's because of the financial interests of the institutions that they represented, for reasons that we've been discussing for a while. And in the particular case of the crime against humanity, there was concern, and they wrote it down quite explicitly in diaries and so forth, that if, for example, the Turkish attempt to exterminate the Armenians was recognized as a crime, as it certainly should have been, and in fact as the Americans had promised that it would be during the war, that once, if this was recognized at the end of the war, once the war propaganda was over, then it was quite likely that the Americans themselves would find themselves in the dock for a crime against humanity in connection with slavery, with the extermination of indigenous peoples, with their role in the mass murders in the Philippines at the turn of the century, and a whole list of other offenses that I imagine your listeners are familiar with. So the John Foster Dulleses of the world, and again, we're talking about a very small number of people here, had a great interest in limiting the definition of these crimes. So, when Hitler came to power, and when the extermination of the first things that he did as far as persecution of Jews
were dispossessing Jews, taking away their property, taking away their ability to make a living. Petty persecution, petty quote-unquote, in the sense of expelling them from schools or from professions, beating them up, that type of thing. And those are serious crimes, yet they are of a different order than mass murder. As the Nazi state moved from this quote-unquote petty form of persecution, which was evil enough, into an exterminationist form of persecution, then this was a relatively public event. I mean, people who were reading European newspapers or reading German newspapers had a pretty good idea of what was going on. And so the question came up in the legal advisor's office of the U.S. State Department, legal advisor's office in the foreign office of the United Kingdom. Well, are we going to intervene as Nazi Germany deports certain categories of people to concentration camps, which are, by evidence already in our hands, actually death centers where people are starved to death or left to die from the elements? Now, this is before the gas chambers. And the answer that the lawyers came back with was, no, we're not going to intervene. We're not going to get involved in this. Why? It's because it's not illegal. There's no such thing as a crime against humanity. We decided that at the end of World War I. If Hitler wants to treat his people like that, well, then maybe Hitler's a distasteful person, but he's not doing anything against the law. This was the reasoning at the time. I'm not trying to defend this. I'm simply trying to articulate what the story was or what the claim was at the time.
This line of argument centered on a group of State Department functionaries who could be said to be sort of a correlating element to some of the Wall Street elite that we were speaking about earlier, the brothers Dulles and so forth.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. They were very much intertwined with each other. And once again, this is not like some sort of Illuminati conspiracy BS. I mean, this... You can sit down and look at the foreign, the staffs of the state, the foreign service of the United States State Department, and the, you know, the kind of the graduate list from Princeton and the lawyers from Wall Street and so forth, and see enormous familial overlap, people moving through revolving door type jobs and so forth.
We're talking, by the way, about the Regia faction within the State Department, and I think a better way of understanding how they function is to substitute the term networking for a conspiracy.
Sure. Networking is a way to look at it. In one way, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, if there's only a handful, if there's a relative handful of people on Wall Street who are used to dealing with Germans and with the German economy and no up from down as far as various parts of Europe are concerned, then it's not surprising that that some of those same folks will end up, at least in some administrations, in posts where they're representing the U.S. government in dealing with Europe. And in fact, somewhat the same phenomena continues to this day.
Sure.
At that time, it was particularly intense and particularly inbred and particularly small and tight circles, in part because, in a metaphorical sense, the world was a smaller place in those days. So that rather than having kind of a stratum of people doing these jobs, you really had a country club full of these people doing these jobs, and that was about it. But to get back to the genocide question, they had defined war crime in a certain way at the end of World War I, mainly because it was profitable for them to do it that way. And they had refused, in the face of great popular outcry at the time, to recognize that there was such a thing as a crime against humanity, such a thing as a crime which a government commits against its own citizens, for example. That's one type of crime against humanity. Such a thing as genocide, or a crime in which a state sets out to exterminate an entire people, even though they had seen that with their own eyes in the Turkish attempt to exterminate the Armenians, and even though they had documented that with, you know, in their own archives, again, in the Turkish attempt to exterminate the Armenians. From a legal standpoint, that crime was said not to exist. So that when Hitler came along, his ability to, first of all, set the foundation for mass extermination of Jews and eventually of other peoples as well, and to begin the process of that extermination, was shored up. It was helped out, it's not too much to say, by people, particularly in the legal advisors' offices of the state departments and foreign ministries, that said, hands off, don't get involved, this is none of our business, there's no basis in international law to even make a protest over this. And that theory of how international law should work remained the dominant theory, certainly up till the International Tribunal at Nuremberg, and continues to be felt in a variety of ways to this day.
A couple of sentences that I'd like to read about the political philosophy of the Rija Group, who again were sort of a State Department element that corresponded to some of the Wall Street operators that we alluded to earlier. On page 52 of the paperback edition, you write, "More to the point here, however, is the Rija Group's impact on U.S.-German relations, particularly after Hitler came to power. Perhaps the most influential proponent of the Rija axioms inside the government during the Roosevelt years was FDR's first ambassador to Moscow, William Bullitt." By the way, that's with two L's, an I, and two T's. "He had arrived in the USSR full of enthusiasm for normalized U.S.-Soviet relations, but he felt soon after convinced, quote, that only Nazi Germany could stay the advance of Soviet Bolshevism into Europe," unquote, a view that was shared by others, such as people like Robert Murphy. And then later you write, again, of the same type of faction and their attitudes towards war crimes with regard to the Germans' use of slave labor. Quote, "For them, forced labor seemed little more than a particularly harsh solution to problems that were common to U.S. and German elites." Chris, we've got just about 10 minutes left in the interview, and I'd like to develop those points a little further and talk about how people like Robert Murphy, George Keenan of that Rija faction, and later people like Alan Dulles and William Draper came to be involved with seeing to the reconstruction of Germany after World War II, in effect, at a situation not unlike what had happened after World War I.
Right, right. Well,
again, I realize this is a tall order for 10 minutes. Right.
Sure. I mean, we were talking earlier about how quite a number of empires came to an end during World War I, and one of them, of course, was that of Tsarist Russia, whose government was overthrown by a communist revolution. Now, the big capitalists, the big business, the social leaders, the chambers of commerce and so forth, were appalled by this development. It's because this kind of class-based struggle had been a characteristic of America for 40, 50 years at that point. The IWW, the Wobblies, were a potent political force in the United States at that time. The labor unions were, in many cases, virtually illegal in the United States. And along comes a movement that says labor should rule. Well, so the U.S. government was not happy with this. So you had growing in the State Department a particular analysis of how do you respond to Bolshevik Russia? What do you do with them? And you had some people who favored dealing with Soviet Russia more or less as a conventional power. And and establishing more or less conventional diplomatic relations. And you had others whose strategy was to systematically undermine and attempt to overthrow that particular government. The latter group were called the Rija or the Riga faction. That particular term was coined by a very mainstream American historian, Daniel Yergin, who wrote a quite good study of the emergence of this group. Okay, well, so who was in this group? Well, you had people who, like George Kennan, who is with us today, who remains the big deal, you know, the so-called wise man that were very influential in U.S.-Soviet policy after 1945.
Someone you write extensively about in Blowback, too.
Sure. Robert Murphy, who was Assistant Secretary of State and under three or four different presidential administrations, and at one point was a acting Secretary of State and so on. A man very influential as far as U.S. international relations are concerned. And a core group of more or less similar thinking people in the State Department whose specialty was dealing with Eastern Europe. And Bulat, as you read, was one of them. And Bulat was sent to, when Roosevelt came to power, one of the things that he did was to attempt to reopen rational or more or less conventional diplomatic relations with the Soviets. It was a particularly hard time to do that. It's because, for one thing, the United States was in an economic crisis. For another thing, the Soviet Union was in the midst of a major land and class upsurge, which in the end turned rather bloody in quite a number of places. Stalin was solidifying his power, and you know, so forth and so on. So, creating normal diplomatic relations was not a particularly easy job. On top of that, the revolutionary core that had brought the communists to power, or the revolutionary ideals, put it that way, that the communists had been able to articulate, and on that basis to win power and win popular support, they had yet to turn sour in the minds of many people. And so literally millions of people around the world looked to the Soviet Union as the model of a new society, a new world, a better way of life, and so forth and so on. Now, you know, there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then, I'm not sure. In fact, I'm quite sure that's not the way the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore. But the point is that at that time, that was the way it appeared. So when Bulat went there, Bulat was very much a son of the ruling class, a ruling elite, however you want to put it. He went there as Roosevelt's emissary with an idea of establishing more or less rational relations with the Soviets, and then he returned literally within months, saying that the only thing to do with the Soviets was to encourage the Nazis to go to war with them, and that particular trend of thinking remained entrenched and dominant, really, in the U.S. State Department throughout the 1930s, throughout Hitler's rise, and throughout Hitler's consolidation of power.
You mentioned that there was a struggle within the U.S. State Department between this Riga faction. Is it pronounced Riga or Rija?
Riga is
the correct pronunciation. Anyway, the Riga faction and those who were attempting to administer the policy that had actually been the policies that had been enunciated by people like Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
Ultimately, the Robert Murphys and the Riga faction prevailed. And you mentioned that with regard to the administration of intelligence in Germany, Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, who was working for OSS, became the primary U.S. functionary, and at the same time, another member of this Wall Street elite who was wearing another national security hat, William Draper of Dillon Reed, became a key U.S. official with regard to frustrating the decarbonization of Germany. In our last couple of minutes, I wonder if you could, as briefly as possible, detail that for us, bearing in mind the impossibility of really doing that justice.
Okay, well, I mean, basically what you had happen is that what we've been seeing so far is the emergence of this small, relatively small circle of people who specialized in U.S.-German relations, and also in this kind of triangular relationship between the United States, Germany, and the Soviet Union. And those three relationships were really very important as far as American foreign policy for Europe was concerned throughout the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and so on. And we're talking about a relative handful of people who make the decisions about what's going to be done there. The ones who were making the decisions in the 1920s about banking and investment were, by the 1940s, the ones who were in charge of the, in some cases, in charge of parts of the American war effort against the Nazi government. And then, after Hitler was gone, in charge of the American occupation of Germany, when all of the very complicated questions involving how do you denazify a country that has been a Nazi country, an enthusiastic, by the way, Nazi country for almost two decades, how do you denazify that sort of situation? How do you reconstruct Germany? How do you put a country back on its feet so it can survive economically, and so forth and so on? These are not easy questions to answer. And the ones who had the appearance of being experts at answering these questions were precisely the ones who had been personally involved in creating the economic and political conditions that had led to Hitler's rise to power, who had participated in business deals with major German companies during Hitler's rule, and who in many cases had personal or familial economic interests in companies that were profiting from Germany's reconstruction. William Draper is one example that you use.
And he, by the way, we're almost out of time. He was a general at the end of the war, and he had been a key official with Dillon Reed in helping to promote U.S. investment in Germany. And then, as I said, Alan Dulles from Sullivan and Cromwell had a lot to do with administering intelligence matters. And, of course, Alan Dulles and people like George Kennan and others figure prominently in your book, Blowback, which follows in many ways on the work that you did in Splendid Blonde Beast. We've been speaking with Christopher Simpson, the author of the vitally important book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, published in softcover by Common Courage Press, copyright 1995. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.
And for Christopher Simpson, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.